Hello, my name is Daniel Morden. I'm a storyteller. Between 2018 and 2021, I'm going to be visiting fellow at the University of South Wales. As a result, I'm going to do a podcast interviewing a variety of different artists from different art forms who use traditional stories in their work in some way or another. I am sitting with Kate Tempest. Kate, can you tell me what you understand a story to be?
A story is a moment in an imagined life that brings you closer to a moment in your own.
So that's why we tell them.
Yeah, so I think that the purpose of telling stories is about connection to your own experience, to other people's experience, and probably for understanding, for clarity, and for entertainment, learning, lots of reasons. I think like the grip of a good story, you know, when it has you, it's unlike anything else, isn't it? It's like, even when it's a story, like a bit of gossip about a friend, you know, when it's just when it gets you and you're like, wow, what happened? How did that happen? I was reading this book that my publisher gave me by a guy called Will Storr, which is called Selfie. It's an exploration of how the West became obsessed with the idea of self. And he talks about how gossip, it's a kind of crucial part of how we've evolved.
Mm.
Because historically in the tribes, if somebody acted out of selfishness, it went against the good of the group, but it could potentially be life-threatening for the group. So if somebody, you know, ran off in the night with the kill, no one else could eat. So gossiping about bad behaviour helps us reaffirm ideas of good behaviour and keeps us in our place within the tribe. And then you can trace that all the way through to right now when we watch these films or we read these books or we tell these stories about moral crises of some sort. And we align ourselves with the kind of people we'd like to be.
I'm thinking about Orpheus. I keep thinking about Orpheus. He loses his wife. He's a musician. He goes down into the underworld. He plays a piece of music so extraordinary that Hades says, all right, you can have her back.
Yeah.
He says, he makes Hades remember his own love. And he says, there's only one thing, Orpheus. When you travel back, don't look behind you.
Mm.
So as soon as we hear those words, we know what's coming.
Mm.
Because we're us. We know that as soon as that embargo has been set, it will be broken. And there's something consoling about that for me, that he can't not look behind him. He can't not look. I mean, Ovid says that he hears his wife stumble, and that's why he turns. But there's something so intensely human about that mistake.
But also, why was the embargo set? Why give someone this opportunity to fuck it up? You know, sorry for swearing, but like, what? You know, in all these stories about, and then they broke the rule. Like, but why? Why is it important in the story that the rule is set in the first place? You know.
I don't know. That's a good question. That's an interesting question. You work within a contemporary, a very contemporary form, a lot of the time. And yet you draw on traditional stories. Can you explain to me why they seem so inspiring or useful to you?
I think that in some ways there is a backdrop when I'm looking out of my eyes into whatever I'm looking at. And the way that I understand the world as I experience it is kind of set in this mythological context. Probably because I used to read so much as a kid. I took real comfort in books, and they were like a safe place to go and all this kind of stuff. You know, kids that love to read, they just get lost in reading, don't they? It's like, in some ways it wasn't even a knowing decision. Like, it's not like I decided I wanted to set contemporary stories against tradition. It is just how I experience what I experience. But then as I got more into my craft and started to discover my strengths, etc., and where I wanted to push my writing to, I've found that pinning something on an ancient story or at least introducing some old element, some ancient element, it enables me to connect with the timelessness of experience. And that, for me, that's just, it's useful, because you can get too focused on the here and now, and you can imagine to yourself that it is only ever the here and now, but it isn't that, it's eternal. And this is, for me, is really helpful and soothing and all of the things, you know, when we begin to panic about where we're heading, I take great comfort in the fact that we've been playing the same dramas for thousands of years and more.
That's why there are those embargoes.
Yeah.
I do. I think that's why there are those embargoes. They're necessary for the story, so that the central character can prove himself or herself human. That's what they're there. They serve a narrative function. There isn't a logic to them for the person who sets the embargo, necessarily.
Yeah.
Hades sets the embargo because Orpheus breaks it. You know, to establish ourselves human, that Orpheus is human, and that he's fallible, and that he makes mistakes. And that is consoling for the rest of us.
Mm.
Alan Bennett said, when you're touched by a poem or a story from long ago, he said, it's like a hand has reached out the darkness and taken your own.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Beautifully put.
Yeah, and you feel less alone.
Mm.
And when Orpheus looks behind him, that's the moment when I think, it's for me. Mm. This story's for me.
Mm.
Because I would have looked behind me too. You know?
Yeah.
But I've been reading Hold Your Own.
Mm.
And the mileage you get out of Tiresias, the way that you use that story to raise issues for now, the way that old story suddenly, because of the way you treat it, seems so contemporary. Yeah, it's a story that I tell, but reading Hold Your Own, I saw it in a new way.
That's good. I feel like with that particular story, I was carrying that around for a long time.
Yeah.
I found great comfort in this figure of Tiresias. She used to crop up all the time at the end of other people's stories and tell them things they didn't want to know, and I wander off and I just think, like, who is that? Where are they from? This old blind prophet led by a child sometimes, or just think, like, what the fuck is, like, who? I was always really struck, and then I discovered that they had lived as both male and female, and for me that was really interesting, and it was an example of fluidity of gender that I found comforting, you know, this hand out of the darkness, all this stuff, you know, and it enables me to write about those things, but in a way that feels more universal than if I was to just write about my own experience, which this is a vehicle for me to write about everything I hold to be true or questions that I have, but it, in a way that hopefully opens it out to the experience of other people, which I think for poetry, it must be searching for other people's experience. You know, even when it's dealing with something that's personal or intimate, it should still be reaching out. And Tiresias, I was just electrified by that story. And it dawned on me pretty soon after deciding to write the poems I wanted to write, set them that way. It dawned on me that this would be the vehicle, that Tiresias would be the organising principle of this collection. And then once I'd had that realisation, I couldn't stop thinking about all of the different people around me that could be Tiresias at any point. And this idea of, like, well, he's had all these lives, she's had all these lives, and then suddenly at the end of all these lives, at the end of all that experience, then blinded and given this new role, just like the human reality of that many transitions and that the cost to your soul to have to be suddenly this seer at the end of your life, you know.
There's a quote you put in the book from one of the plays, which is something like, you crave knowledge, but soon you'll long for ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Russell Hoban has a piece called A Conversation with the Head of Orpheus. You know, eventually Orpheus's head's taken off. You know, when separated from his body, when Orpheus is dead, it speaks prophecies.
Mm.
And Orpheus says to Russell Hoban, do you want to hear my story? And Russell Hoban says, yes, of course I do, that's why I'm here. And Orpheus says, well, there's a price. And he says, what's the price? And Orpheus says, well, as soon as you hear it, you'll know it. And once you know it, you can't unknow it. The other figure who fascinates me, who I've never been able to do anything meaningful with, and I it's like a pebble in my shoe, this one, is Cassandra. She's the one person who knows what's going to happen. And no one, she's cursed to be ignored. Now, it's a sort of narrative cul-de-sac, because she says the same function over and over again. She's like, listen to me, look what's happening. But it just feels like a really contemporary character right now. It just feels like last week, there was a debate on climate change in the House of Commons, and very few MPs actually showed up. I have a friend who's a Native American storyteller, and she said to me, oh, I decided to see if I find equivalents in my own culture of Cassandra. But then I realised my culture just wasn't as stupid as your culture. I couldn't find any. I walk around with these characters in my head and the things they do and the choices they make, and I can see how they connect with my own predicament and our society's predicament. And I find that enormously consoling and inspiring that we're still making the same mistakes. And the image that I have is of a stories that are like cairns. You know, you're walking across the mountain in the fog and you get completely lost. And then you come on this heap of rocks that other people have left. People have made the same journey. So that way you know you're on the right track.
But, you know, they can lead you astray as well. You know, if you think about the bigger stories that we have constructed our entire civilization around. And I suppose what's interesting about this moment is that the story is changing. The narrative is attempting to change, or is people are trying to change it. And there is this moment of confusion because the story is changing. And this must have happened at when Christianity took over and as the dominant narrative organising principle, and then again also, you know, as it collapsed and in the Enlightenment, and it's happening again. And there's something about these wider narratives. They take on this huge power. We can't see the end of them. We can't imagine life without them. Thank God they change, or they, you know. But I feel like at the minute there's this kind of this quite beautiful but terrifying moment of reveal. It's like we're looking underneath this story and we're seeing the cost of these made up things that we've decided to live for, and we're learning to take responsibility, to acknowledge accountability, all these things that are happening because there are new ways of sharing stories, new way of hearing other people's stories. There's a need for these cairns, you know. Because then, and somehow they need to look different to all the other cairns that have been left that have led us to terrible, terrible places.
To me, you seem very prolific. I've got a writer friend who says, if I don't do any writing for 3 or 4 days, I start getting kind of semi-panic attacks. I start biting my nails, I start getting anxious. Can you relate to that?
Yeah, absolutely. But sometimes time does go past and I haven't written. It does make me feel blocked, uncomfortable, unable to commit to experience, to life. And often it's when you're at your most kind of stressed out, or if you're dealing with something that's particularly difficult, something traumatic, like when you need the creative outlet the most, sometimes that's when you go to it the least, because you know what it's going to take out of you, and actually you know what it demands of you. You need to very much center yourself and go into it. And sometimes if you're at the end of your tether, you just feel like you don't have the energy to kind of deliver yourself to creativity. But it always comes back. This is the beautiful thing about it. Like, I just spent a year working on something that went nowhere, to be honest. It's no good. And other things as well. But I really took a chunk of time out to work on this one thing, to really go there with it. And it's the first time where I've realised that I just poured all this time and energy into something that will never develop, it will never become, and it I found it exhausting having that realization. I found the whole process exhausting. The first time that writing had been like, it was like wearing a fucking huge concrete hat sitting down to write. You know, it's usually, obviously it's difficult, but it was never this heavy. And it's because the idea was wrong, the characters were wrong, something was wrong. Like, I shouldn't have been pursuing this white rabbit, you know, I shouldn't have been following this blind path. But actually what's happened is coming out of the back of this time, I'm finding the fluidity again, like the wave. Suddenly creativity feels like elemental again. It feels like a storm. All these things that it always used to feel like. And I'm back in the studio working on some music, and I'm writing little bits for other people again, and also writing for nothing. You know, important to just write for no fucking reason.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can relate to this. This idea that if your friend doesn't write, they begin to panic. Like, I absolutely connect with that. But it's so hard to remember that when you're in the middle of a panic, being like, "Why am I in this terrible state?" Yeah. And it's like,
I watch your performances, and I sort of sometimes worry for your well-being. You know, they seem so intense. They seem so. You seem to put everything into those performances, and as a performer, I know what it takes out of me to be in front of an audience. I mean, I like you, work with musicians, but they're cracking jokes and moments before the show.
Mm.
And I'm...
yeah.
I mean, the arty way, the poncy way to describe it, I suppose, would be to say I'm in the zone. But that's what I want to do. I want to be completely silent, and I want to be thinking about what I'm about to do and thinking about the images in it.
Yeah.
And try and not in a kind of outside way, not in a kind of technical way, like I want to stand there when I'm doing that bit and stand there when I'm doing that bit, but kind of enter the mindset of the characters and return to the reason why I made this piece before I step out in front of an audience. So I get a very clear sense that my musicians, I mean, they're into it, they love it, they wouldn't do it if they didn't love it, but I get them to drive home because I'm cross-eyed at the end of the show.
Mm.
And it always looks to me like, you know, you just seem to put so much into it. If you're feeling, are you knackered or at the end, or are you kind of empowered by surfing this wave of audience response and communion? And
it depends. It depends how long I've been touring.
Yeah.
Like, it depends how the gig feels, like what the room feels like. If sometimes it can feel extremely demanding, and it's got nothing to do with the size of the audience. It's about what the people that have come to see the show have been through that day, because they carry it into the room with them.
Yeah.
Sometimes you come out like, whoa, what is this in the room? You don't know what it is, and it can make you feel weird, and then you're on the back foot, and you can't enter, and then you give yourself a hard time for it, and then you're not fully in it. And then the thing of it is what I'm trying to remember when it becomes difficult and I am struggling and I am tired, like, yeah, of course, you know, I get really tired out by it. It's fucking intense.
It is intense.
But what I try and remember is that, like, okay, look, this is coming from a place that is not in me.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not doing this. Like, it's not me. Like, and then if you take that pressure off yourself, then you can't get in the way too much. Like, it's all being well, it might sound a bit pretentious, but it's how I genuinely feel. So you become a channel, you know, it comes through you. You connect with your musicians, and together you will go somewhere.
Yeah.
That's when it's transcendent and electric, and it gives you energy, and you come off stage feeling like something incredible happened, you know. And obviously it can't be like that every time. Sometimes it feels like hard work and you're going through the motions, but that's when you're too involved. I start to think about what I'm saying, where I got you now. Because your kind of receiver is worn out, the circuitry's gone, maybe you drank too much, or you haven't put yourself in that zone, as you say, where you're thinking about the images and you're ready to really go truly there. Like, I definitely would say that life on the road for musicians and poets and anybody that has a connection to make, it's It's treacherous. Like, it's a treacherous environment for your mental health. It's very difficult. But at the same time, it's my one true love. It's my big ambition. And it's I have to always remind myself that this is everything I've ever wanted, and there are people coming to here, and I have something to offer them that is important for me anyway, and hopefully for them.
So, well, there are two things that come up from that. The first is my previous interviewee, Alan Moore, said, I think of myself as a window.
Mm.
He said, he said, I'm a window. It's very easy to believe that I made the light, but I didn't. I'm just the window.
Mm.
And all I can do is perhaps expand my width or make sure that I'm clean in order to make the light shine through.
Yeah.
But that's my responsibility. So there's that. The other thing that I'm curious about is how many gigs can you do where, for reasons outside your control, they don't work? How many gigs in a row before you start thinking, it must be me? How many gigs before you start getting serious kind of, oh?
I don't know, like, when you have a tour to do, you have an amount of gigs that you've just got to get through.
Yep.
And thankfully, it's very rare that you have more than, like, two shockers in a row. Like, luckily, after that, something, you know, the universe gets involved and says, don't worry. You know, even if you're really scraping the barrel and you're at the end, you know, you're tired, and even then, like, something beautiful happens out of that exhaustion, or there's some new connection that you find with somebody either on stage with you or in the audience. Things need to change so that you can remember why you're telling these stories.
Yeah, I agree with that so much. I find, you know, I've got my show. There are elements of improvisation in it, but we play a huge range of environments, you know, from theatres with lights and light and cues and a controlled environment to little village halls, to schools, to festivals. And each environment has its own little quirks, and that affects the performance, and that is good for me, because as you say, the result of that is that I had a friend who, she's up the road at the moment actually in 9 to 5, the Dolly Parton musical, and she did 18 months as Mary Poppins around America, and I said to her, how do you do it, you know, how do you keep, because you can't, like, I deviate, I can't help myself, I improvise. But she can't, you know.
But the thing is, she is an actor
with
a role
to
play.
That's right.
And it's a different mindset.
It's a different
craft, different skill, all that. Yeah. And the parameters in place for her to do her thing, you know, are very specific. She has a director, she has a producer, she has the stage manager. There's all this stuff going on to hold this space for this particular story to be told. It's not her, so no matter how she's doing, it's not her, it's Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
So even if she's at the end of her tether, Mary Poppins is going to come out. And
but Brian Eno, you know, Brian Eno said, I knew I had to quit Roxy Music when I was on stage during a gig thinking about my laundry.
There you go, that's definitely time to quit then, isn't it?
And I suppose what I'm doing is I'm projecting how I would be on my friend who is Mary Poppins.
Mm.
Because I asked her and she said, well, for about 5 weeks, I pretended I was Dame Maggie Smith on stage every night. And it kind of shifted my own relationship with what I was doing. So she did chafe a bit. But I can do about 40 performances of the same show in a short period of time, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 months.
Wow,
before
I'm
thinking about my laundry.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah.
After that, I don't really want to do it anymore.
Mm.
I don't really want to do it anymore, ever.
Mm. You know, I can use elements, because most of the stories I do have stories within them that I can lift out and tell them in other contexts. And I don't mind doing that. But in that kind of structure that I've made, after that period, I'm like, enough. What about you? I mean, do you, you do a piece? I mean, obviously, it has a life as a book. It has a life as a recording. It has a life because you can visit it on YouTube. But would you go back and do...
No. My experiences of that are that sometimes the piece is too much for me and I can't take it, like Brand New Ancients. It became too much. I couldn't deal with it. And the show could have had more life, but I personally couldn't have given it that life. So I had to stop doing that. Which I just knew I needed to move into new things. It was a really demanding story, and it was a violent story. And so to be able to like invite that violence into a space every night, you need to be really ready to take people there. And I was not well at that time, so I stopped doing Brand New Ancients, and I don't think I'll do it again. That was in like 2012 or 13. Probably 13 that I stopped doing that, and it felt electric and fantastic to finish, and like it was like it felt like the right thing to have created this thing and to have worked with it and then to be leaving it. And then with my poetry book, with Hold Your Own, I toured it some. You know, it wasn't quite the same thing as touring like a big story or a show or with a band. It was just me just reading some poems from this book in really random places. So it didn't feel like I'd really gone there with it. So I feel quite comfortable now to tell poems from that collection in different contexts. They still feel like they have life there. Mm. And then with the albums, with Everybody Down, which is the first album, and Let Them Eat Chaos, which was the most recent one, you do the tour of that album, and within that tour it grows. Musically it grows, like everything about it changes. Yeah. It begins to have this new live life.
Yeah.
We toured Everybody Down for about 18 months, which is
right.
the kind of natural touring cycle for an album.
Yeah.
It's not constant, you're doing other things.
No, it seems me, it seems me.
And then I don't feel like I want to do that anymore, like because I don't feel like that person who wrote those songs, but it's not like I'm not like sure that I would never do that again in the same way I am about Brand New Ancients, which is a story that feels closed for me. And then with my most recent poetry collection, which was a very intimate collection of love poems about heartbreak and a new romance and a new love, I decided pretty much as soon as I knew that collection was going to be that I couldn't tour it. These poems do not live in rooms. They were for the page.
They're private company.
And I knew that. And so I made a decision to not have these poems live that way, and it felt like the right decision. And I read them once to like kind of launch it or whatever. And I was just up there reading them, and I was like, fuck, this is incredible because it's only once.
Yeah.
But if I had to do this again tomorrow, like I would not be able to fucking do this.
I do this festival in Belgium every other year. And it's thousands of teenagers don't want to be there.
Cool.
They're busting from all over the shop to a castle, and it's a way of them learning language.
Wow.
So they'll go and hear stories from mother tongue storytellers in a variety of different languages.
Wow, they would never do that in England.
No, they wouldn't. But the thing is, there's a drawback to it, which is they don't want to be there.
Yeah, of course.
You've got to win them over. And one strategy, I mean, in a way, that's good, isn't it? But one strategy is to tell shocking stories to them, to sort of shock them into understanding that you're not patronising them.
Mm.
But it's really hard because I don't like telling disturbing stories. I mean, I quite like challenging stories. I want to tell challenging stories, but stories that are just twisted. It's a bit like you were saying about Brand New Ancients. I don't, on some level, I metabolise them, you know, and I don't really want.
Because it's all they're in your memory, aren't they? They're in your body, and then you kind of summon them to tell the story. So you've definitely metabolized them. They're in you, and then you've got to like summon them out. And even if it's not your story, I mean, what I mean by that is it's an old story. It's been through story. Many.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still you in that moment who is summoning it, making it real. So that must be fucking crazy to be like, well, this is a really violent or difficult or shocking story.
I mean,
but I've seen you tell some dark stories and it's been joyous. You know, I've seen you do the kind of the truly grim fairy tales.
Yeah. But I mean,
you know, the grim ones, they're not all. Well, I'll start again. I'm not an actor, so I don't tell anything that I can't relate to. You know, the actor's skill is if they give the actor the script, which is to say Andrex toilet paper, soft, strong, and very, very long, the actor's skill is to invest that with conviction and meaning and to make it, not meaning, but conviction. I can't do that. If I used to work for a classical Indian dance company. They were enacting stories, but the audience over here didn't understand the stories they were enacting. So I was the sort of mediator. I would explain what the dance was by telling the story in advance. So I'd be given stories because the company wanted to perform certain dances. It's really hard. Because I didn't necessarily relate to the story in the slightest. And so even those stories I'm telling to the Belgian teenagers, I only tell ones that I think have got something in them that I find intriguing or challenging. But also, I have to try and find them which is also sufficiently shocking to
shake them up a bit. But the upshot of that is that, you know, I don't ever tell anything that I think that's just completely nasty. Like, I did have a go at some M.R. James stories and I just dropped them because I just thought they were poisonous and full of a kind of bizarre misogyny. I just found them really horrible. So I stopped telling them completely. But there are other stories that, like you say, grim. But the grim ones I tell, they've got something else to them as well as the grim.
Yeah, and that's why they're so satisfying to listen to. Because the yarn of it and the action packed pace of it, those kind of stories, the closest thing we can relate them to is like watching a kind of blockbuster movie, for example. But there's never anything really, there isn't the satisfaction of there being this more interesting subtext with those, because it's for what it's for. It's just, you know, it's just to kind of take your mind off whatever you've been up to that day, just watch some fucking, you know, dumb shit that's enjoyable for no reason really, other than you can just not think while you watch it. But when I was listening to your stories that have that kind of similar like glee factor of like, oh my god, no, don't go in there, or like, like, no shit, like, quick, hurry up, or whatever it is, I suppose just because you're the listener is summoning it for themselves, that you have to be involved, like you have a role in that exchange. You can't just sit and watch it, you have to actively listen and summon and be a part of this like conjuring. And like, actually the best part of that is that it happens so naturally that you realise you have this capacity for imagination, that often listening to something or watching something doesn't require much imagination from you, but it's so satisfying when it does, you know. Or if you listen to a record that is just For some reason, it engages you in a less passive way than when you're kind of putting something on which intentionally you want it to stop your imagination. So.
Well, when I was ill, I took my kids. I couldn't go out much because I had a compromised immune system. But one night, I took my kids to see a Bond film.
Right.
And it's a bit like, there's a quote from Emily Dickinson who said, the circus went by 3 days ago and the colours of the wagons are still fused on my retina even now.
because she had such a sort of closeted experience of life, you know. Mm. She was inside a lot, and I'd been inside a lot.
Mm.
And then I went to see this film, and it was
utterly
mind-blowing. And it finished, and I felt better.
Mm.
I did feel better, and I suddenly, my sense of what escapism is shifted somewhat.
Yeah.
Because I suddenly felt, actually, I haven't been carrying all that anxiety for the duration of this period.
Yes, and you just went with it.
And my muscles aren't aching in the way that they were before.
Yeah,
because I'm, you know, I relaxed. I was kind of somebody else.
Yes,
and I sort of thought, actually, there's a place for escapism.
Absolutely. It's important. It's important, yeah. And in a situation as extreme as that, you know, when it's an escape from a physical pain, you know, like what your muscles were going through, and the fact that to relax for 2 hours and take your mind off it, you probably don't even realise that you haven't relaxed until you're like, what the hell is this feeling? Wow, I haven't thought about it. But also on an everyday kind of level, this is why you get on the train and everybody's looking at their phones, is because we want escape. We want something to distract us. We need something to turn it off for a minute. Yeah. And it's like so attractive, this other life of James Bond, or you know, whatever it is that we're watching or listening to. I think it's tempting to feel worried about our appetite for escapism. But also, when you look at the reality of like what our lives actually consist of, it's like, why wouldn't you like make up loads of cool stuff to think about?
I always feel quite ambivalent about the phone thing, because people do a lot of stuff on those phones, so it isn't automatic that they're doing something just to distract themselves. I mean, people.
Yeah, they're working or they're getting.
You could be reading Sufi poetry, couldn't you? You know, you could be doing. You know, there's such a variety of stuff you can be doing on those.
It just feels so. It feels so mute.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
of the head down how lost we get in whatever it is that we're doing, and then so to be amongst loads of people not like able to be amongst any people at the same time is.
Yeah.
Just a strange feeling, isn't it?
The novelist Barbara Trepido, she was in New York on a subway, and someone sitting opposite her was reading one of her novels.
Mm.
So she leant over and she said, "Excuse me, are you enjoying that novel?" And the person reading it said, "What's it to you?" And she said,
"New York."
She said, "Well, I wrote it." And the person said, "So?"
I like that person. I mean, fair enough. Like, you know, that person just sitting there reading a book, like, that was, yeah, it's her ego getting involved in his moment. He's just hanging out reading a book. That's kind of cool. I quite like that. I had this cool moment once where I was outside a gig. We were playing a gig in this, like, big cathedral in Hull. It was like the city of culture, so they had this gig. And so they were bringing loads of stuff in and out, you know, to like rig this space. I was standing outside having a cigarette and I had my dog with me. And this guy walked past and he kind of started like looking at the dog. And we started talking about dogs. And then he was like, "What's going on?" He said, "My wife's going." He said, "How's that going in there? It's a gig in there tonight, isn't it?" I was like, yeah, they're just like rigging it up. He said, "Oh yeah, my wife's going to that." And I said, "Are you not going?" He said, "Oh no, I can't stand her, that girl, that Kate Temple. I can't fucking stand her." I just sat there like, this is amazing. And so I just was like, yeah, you know. I let him kind of talk it out. And we had like a really nice chat about the dog and about the cathedral. And then off he went. It was this moment of like, wow, I got to involve myself in this like moment. It was like this forbidden like slip of reality where I got to just be someone else for a minute.
Yeah. When we were arranging this meeting, I said, "Oh, come over, because I'm doing a show on Wednesday night."
And then I wondered whether you could, or whether, I mean, have you reached the point where people are going to hassle you then?
No, I mean, sometimes you do find that people want to let you know that they know about your music.
Yeah,
like they want to come over and say, I've heard, or your poetry. It can only be problematic if they need to tell you something very important and profound that your poetry has done,
yeah,
and you are in a very different situation. Like, I can't be the person who's involved in that moment, because if my poem was extremely important for them in a moment, like, I wasn't there, I don't know what that is. And like,
yeah,
in the moment that I might be out watching your show,
yeah,
I might be feeling shy, not really able to be,
yeah,
powerful for,
yeah,
them,
yeah, yeah,
and I might have had an argument with my fucking girlfriend,
yeah,
I might,
yeah,
my mum might be unwell, like,
yeah,
I might have, like, whatever. Suddenly you've just got a BK Tempest, and
yeah,
that's when it becomes worrying, because you're like, fuck, I want to give you this profound moment that I know you want to have with me, but
I don't know what it is.
I'm in a different place. Sometimes it's embarrassing, but it happened to me in the swimming pool once. Just like, no, I'm in the swimming pool, like, the most embarrassing place that it's like you're most vulnerable,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
The guy was like, "You okay, Tempest?" I was just like, "No." I just couldn't deal with it. I was like, "For fuck's sake!" But where's your show? Is it at the BAC?
It's at Rich Mix.
The Rich Mix, right? How are you feeling about it?
Well, it's really exciting. I'm sharing the stage with three other performers. One of them is Toop, who raps for Transglobal.
Mm-hmm.
And tell stories as well. One of them is an Irish teller called Claire Murphy, who I've recently done a big show with, which I've really enjoyed. And the third one is called Sarah Lisa Wilkinson, and she's a new voice. So the Crick Crack Club, who've organised it, have put together this idea, which is that they're going to look at the archetypes. They're going to have a series of evenings,
mm,
and theme each evening. And in each case, the tellers will bring different perspectives on the specific archetypes of that evening.
Great.
So, as you would expect from four different practitioners, we all come to our preparation in different ways.
Mm.
So there's actually only so much. You can't kind of machine tool this thing into, right, you do that, I do this, you do that, I do this. With four people with such different personalities and such kind of mercurial creative practices, such complex creative practices, we've had a correspondence about what we're gonna do so that we know we're not gonna do the same thing.
Mm.
All of us do the same thing. But there's still an awful lot of imponderables. And that for me is really exciting.
That's cool, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you still do kind of shared evenings, but there's something really wonderful from a performing point of view,
mm,
about not quite knowing how what you're going to do is going
to
chime.
What's the theme for this evening?
Well, this one is lovers and addicts.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. Wednesday, that is. This Wednesday, tomorrow? Day
no,
after
yes,
tomorrow?
It's Wednesday, yeah. Wednesday. So, I did one
wow,
a couple of months ago.
So, exploring the archetypes of lovers and addicts. Yeah, I need to come to that.
I do like, it's quite a solitary thing a lot of the time, being a storyteller.
Wow, it feels the opposite of that. It feels like a storyteller has constant community around them.
Well, you have an audience if you're lucky,
yeah,
but what's exciting is to have a peer group, you know. I mean, I can talk to musicians, but I can only go so far with them about what I'm doing and
yeah,
how I'm going about doing it. Whereas if I'm with other storytellers, that, or, you know, poets or writers, then I just feel like I can have conversations, or I can be inspired in a different way.
Mm.
So,
but what about collecting them? You go on big journeys to collect stories,
yeah,
no? You go on,
yeah.
So that must be an amazing experience of connection with people that you
it was you don't yeah know. I don't really do it so much anymore, right, but it was really, I mean, I got kids now. I mean, I can't go to Haiti for months at a time anymore.
Mm.
Because I want to be at home talking to my son about his GCSE options.
Yep.
But it was. I mean, it was... I don't know if you've had the experience of meeting practitioners from very different cultures of Europe than your own.
Well, not in the sense of storytellers and going to meet with this desire to learn story. That's I've never done that. It's incredible.
Well, it was incredible. I read this analogy recently about science fiction, which is, in science fiction, you put humanity up against something that isn't humanity, whether it be AI or whether it be aliens. And in the process, you learn more about what humanity is. So that's what it does, you know. It's not really about ray guns and spaceships. It's actually about what makes us human.
Mm.
And so it was when I was doing those visits, you know, that if I was talking to someone who was a storyteller from another culture, I suddenly understood, it threw into relief my own preconceptions about what my art form was and why I was doing it. And it continues to inform my own kind of practice.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I'm ignorant of hip hop. My son would know way more about it than I would. But I remember when we were last together for a sustained period of time, saying to you, you know, who should I listen to? Because all I know is going to the gym and there's a screen up there and there's these gyrating women and this strutting man. And it seems to be all about bragging. Tell me, there's another... I mean, I can see it in the performance poetry, in the spoken word poetry scene. I can see that there are people talking about real things. But it just seems... I suppose, you know, you'd say in any art form, the majority of it is drivel.
Well, hip-hop is counterculture.
And yeah.
It's extremely powerful.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous because it's empowering, and it's a black music that comes directly from black experience, which seeks to empower black listeners.
Yeah.
And is it requires excellence from its practitioners.
It does.
It requires excellence from its enthusiasts, because you need to be up on it if you want to fully get the most out of what your favourite rapper is doing or your favourite dancer. There are technicalities in hip-hop that are so specific, but you have to be invested in the culture, like in any form, to fully appreciate what it is that you're listening to, watching or partaking in. But look, if you go to the gym and you watch those big screens, you're seeing pop music. You're seeing what you're seeing something that is being sold to young children predominantly, which is exciting and it's gonna sell. You're looking at a factory. It's a window to a factory. It's not necessarily, you know, you're not gonna. But the thing is, like, because of just inherent racism and ignorance within our culture, that there feels that there has been this manipulation of hip-hop intentionally, this like distortion of it and this this funneling of it into a place that is easily dismissible or actually is extremely damaging, these negative stereotypes that are very two-dimensional, one-dimensional, of black masculinity, black femininity. Hip-hop for me is like, it's a huge force for good, you know, in my life. In my direct experience of it, it absolutely transformed my experience. And in terms of who to listen to, thankfully, on the underground, there are still people doing incredible things.
Okay.
Like, incredible things that literally, like, rearrange your brain to listen to them rapping. You're like, how are they doing that to me? Like, what are they even saying? How did they get from there to there in two lines and now we're back here? But the thing is, unless you have an avid, like, thirst and appetite for it, then it's the kind of thing that you can't just go in on the surface and be like a kind of bystander. I feel like it's like with any like musical kind of phenomenon, punk or whatever, you know, you can listen to it, but you can't really understand it unless you are taken by it. And like as for you as a storyteller, obviously, like, I would recommend to you Kendrick Lamar, or I'd recommend Pharoah Monch, Ghostface Killah from Wu-Tang, or Chester P from North London. And there are some, there are some rappers who've built their whole thing on one long story. Their whole thing is a story. Like, and everything they do accentuates that story, and it's this crazy, like, multi-level kind of dimensions that they create through their records. But yeah, sometimes they talk about money or women in ways that you could say it's misogynistic or it's bragging, but for me personally, I can look past those references because for me it's just been such a powerful phenomenon, you know?
Is there anyone who, you know, our story uncurls and often, very often, the story will return to the place where it began, and you see the beginning in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I find that intensely satisfying, not just as a storyteller, but as a story lover. Though I know it's going to happen, I still love it when it happens.
Yeah.
Are there other artists who attempt to do that?
Well, Kendrick Lamar, who I just mentioned, on his most recent record, which is called Damn, which is it's kind of an exploration of sins and the sins that are present in Kendrick Lamar's neighbourhood or Kendrick Lamar's imaginary landscape. And on that record, the last song is a description of a moment in which his father decided not to do something, and it led to so without giving too much away, it's a fucking incredible song actually, and because of where it comes in that record, that is an extremely good example actually of this full circle thing happening. And you can understand the circle beginning not even at the beginning of that record, but at the beginning of two records previously, you know.
Okay.
Where Kendrick begins to talk about his life as a young teenager, or the character of K-Dot, who is a character whose lens he raps through. But yeah, definitely it happens, you know. There's an interesting moment on, I could talk about it all day, but it's like, also the thing is, you know, it's better just to listen to it. These kind of things, it's like, I'd want to just play it to you. I think the thing is as well, wordplay, it's different. Like, what's happening in a great piece of like rap lyricism, it's slightly different. The satisfaction you get is slightly different.
I was going to ask you, you said during a tour a piece will become itself more, it will develop, but you're so tight with your words, you know, that you choose your words so precisely, the rhythm of them, the rhyme. Are you able to improvise at all?
Yeah, I used to improvise.
I mean, I know you can improvise, but what I mean is on a tour, does the language develop and progress?
Like, there are things that you might write something a certain way, but it's crap, and you don't realise it until you try and memorise it, and you just can't. The things that fall away from memory are usually the things that should have fallen away from the text. Yeah. And often the things that you can't bring yourself to say are the things that you shouldn't have brought yourself to write. You know, this is something that I feel. So often the text will change, it will find its way into what it becomes each night. And that can be miles away from where it began. But for the most part, I get it memorised, and once I start.
Yeah.
And then I might drop a line or two here or there, or something might change, or if I get distracted and I can't, rec- you know, sometimes what happens is you get distracted and then you can just, you know that the next line sounds like something,
yeah,
but you can't find the actual words. So then you end up replacing it with something that seems kind of similar, and it's such a strange moment of like,
yeah,
disassociation where you suddenly, you're kind of juggling this thing and suddenly that's like some, you know.
I do know that moment. I know that moment very well. I started telling traditional stories fairly straight. You know, mm, I would find a text and obviously I'd take out the antiquated language,
mm,
and I'd try and express what I was attempting to express a little more precisely than, say, a 19th century text would. But as time has gone on, I'm fashioning that material more. You know, there's more attempt to do what I would term literary things rather, mm, than oral things,
mm,
with those stories.
Mm.
And that has meant that it's become more difficult to remember.
Mm.
So,
how much do you remember? Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, how much do you have at one time in your kind of accessible memory, ready to go? How many shows could you do? Or like, I mean, how many hours have you got?
I've got 8 at the moment, evening shows. But I've got a whole other repertoire for kids.
So
kids.
At your fingertips, but I mean, you know, your mental fingertips, at your request, you could summon from your mental chamber 8 hours or more.
No, the most, the shows are either 2 hours or an hour and a half.
Amazing. 16 hours.
But it's an obsession, you know. It's a complete obsession. I mean, how much material do you think you've got?
Not that much. I my memory's really bad. This is the thing. Like, as I move through my life, I realise that my memory's fucking awful, but I can remember whatever it is that I have committed to memory at that time.
Yeah.
But usually, like, something can happen and I suddenly am reminded of something that I had been, you know, some lyric I wrote at 15 or something just comes in. It just comes out of nowhere, and then suddenly you can do the whole thing front to back, like 10 minutes of it or whatever it is. But I couldn't, I could start Brand New Ancients, I couldn't get through it. I could maybe get through some of the other bits. Normally I can just do the thing I'm focused on doing.
Yeah, it's
quite an ask for me to
jump.
Yeah. But it's definitely something that I hugely respect in others. This, the cataloguing of it and keeping it all fresh and accessible. It's cool, man.
It's actually more to do with economic necessity. You know, if someone rings up and says, can you do this?
Can you do this one?
Yeah.
Better be
really,
ready.
Really. It's more to do with economic necessity. So I find myself one day, you know, telling the story of the Trojan War, and the next day I'm telling the gingerbread man in front of a bunch of infants.
What an amazing life.
Yeah, I
think that's the storyteller's job, is to be able to have something for everyone. I had a job when I first started out in a park. I had a coat painting with pictures from stories, and on the back it said, Daniel Morden, teller of myths, legends, riddles, ghost stories, lies, stop me and hear one. So the idea was anyone could ask me for a story. So there were lads at the cider bar, I had to have a story for them. There was a bunch of kids from a nursery school. Then there was a greenhouse with mainly older people wandering around inside the greenhouse looking at the plants and talking about the plants. I had to have something for them. Someone had 2 minutes before their bus arrived. I had to have something for them. They used to have like church services. There was a church in the park. Could you tell a story as part of the service?
Wow.
I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was a fascinating thing to do. You know, I thought it was an endlessly interesting way to make a living. You know, what, you know, you said that long project you did recently that led nowhere.
Mm.
Actually, I would argue it will inform all your subsequent You know, you'll have learned stuff from that.
Definitely did.
Anyway, thank you very much for your time, Kate. And
it's my pleasure.
It's great to see you again. And
I have one more question before we finish, which is that
who's doing the interviewing anyway?
I'm having a chat. I've got a question for you, which is that I'm working on this translation or reimagination of Philoctetes was the wounded soldier. I wonder if you have any, me just dropping that name into your consciousness, Philoctetes, does anything come up for you?
Again, he's a Tiresias. It's almost kind of shamanic what he goes through. The Philoctetes who gets wounded and abandoned, it's not the same Philoctetes who they return to. But the other thing is, bloody Odysseus. Bloody Odysseus. He can talk Philoctetes into going along with them when they get back. Philoctetes is abandoned by them, as far as I can understand, because he was a drag. You know, they had no sense of concern for him. Or he's wounded, he's useless to us. They go to Troy, they fight for all these years. Finally, they discovered, actually, he is useful. In fact, he's absolutely key to us resolving this non-stop. So, oh no, now we're going to have to talk him round to working with us again. Odysseus will do it. And he does. Odysseus is capable of talking anybody into anything. And so Philoctetes, for me, is fascinating because of what he says about Odysseus. But also the suffering, you know, the what he goes through and who he is at the end, who he is when he's fetched out. Like I say, it's like what you said about Tiresias. He gets this new role. And how will he be?
Fantastic. Amazing. I can't believe I could just say any name and you could be like, yeah, Philoctetes.
I've always really liked him. There's a film, a terrible film by Terry Gilliam, about Baron von Munchausen.
Right.
Eric Idle plays the fastest man in the world, who Baron von Munchausen abandons on a planet somewhere. And Baron von Munchausen thinks, oh, hang on, I need him. So Baron von Munchausen goes back and says, I need you. And Eric Idle, playing the fastest man in the world, says, you abandoned me. You left me here. You left me here alone. And now you want me to go with you. And Baron von Munchausen says, yes. And Eric Idle goes, all right then.